2258 and 20507. So, Representative Tootsie Smith, would you like to come forward and talk to us about 2372?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tootsie Smith from Mawala, House District 18. Where's the rest of your committee?
Oh, who knows, but they'll show up, I guarantee it. And I'll pay attention for four or five of them.
Okay, good, good.
Here's one.
I'll wait till he sits down. I'm the sponsor of House Bill 2372. This bill originally passed during the last session with the sunset on it. And this bill exempts the sunset on a property tax exemption allowed for environmentally sensitive logging equipment. And it's basically revenue neutral for the state. However, for people who are in the logging business, this is a very sensitive issue. It gives a small amount of certainty in a field that has much uncertainty in it. The property tax exemption has a positive impact on family business. Such relief of the exemption allows, if you're not paying property taxes on your equipment, you're going to be able to hire more people, pay them better benefits that will ultimately go into the coffers of the state of Oregon. And also, I think we need to support our rural, natural resource-based industries. It'll send a positive signal, you know, to some of those people out there who see very little relief in the logging industry. President Clinton's Timber Forest Plan, very little money trickled down to our local people. A lot of those people are still out of work, and those high-paying family wage jobs have not been replaced. That's basically all. We're just asking for, you know, to make the tax exemption permanent, to eliminate the sunset, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes. I might just ask, do you have any other great things up your sleeve that have no revenue impacts like this?
Well, Representative Hunt, thank you for that. We'll see how much of a difference this makes to some of our people. It could make the difference, in all honesty, of a person staying in business or going out of business and any more. That's, you know, huge. If they can hold on for another year or two while the economy turns around or markets get better, it could make just that difference. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Gilman. Representative Smith, welcome.
Welcome.
Is this a revenue-neutral bill?
Yes, I said that earlier.
I'm sorry, I wasn't here. I just wanted to get it on the record and make sure. Thank you.
You bet.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Smith, thank you for being here. In your testimony, it says this bill exempts the sunset on the property tax exemption.
On property tax deferral.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so do we really mean to just eliminate?
What we're doing is taking away the fact that it will end at the end of this biennium.
But, I mean, do we really, is the best strategy to remove it forever?
Yes.
So that no one else in the next session can come back and put it back in?
Well, no, there's no guarantee of that. Beg your pardon, Chair, Representative Nelson. One legislature cannot bind another on such issues, I don't believe.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. We probably could word it that way.
Oh, okay.
You can't buy the next legislature, you're right.
Well, I don't think we can buy the next legislature as much as I would like to, and thank you for that.
Thank you. And Dr. Bates?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find myself sitting to the right of
Representative Smith, as we always do in our multiple committees, we sit with each other. So I thought I would just try to come in and sit where I usually do, to her right. Not to say that I am politically to her right, but I was asked to testify in this bill, Mr. Chair, because it impacts my area. We have a large number of very small logging outfits. These are usually family-operated. They go from job to job in state and federal land. They usually don't have private land. They have imposed on them something which I agree with, a very much more expensive but effective way of environmentally logging that is much safer for the environment. A lot of it has to do with cabling up in trees. You're not dragging smaller pieces of trees and smaller trees that we're now harvesting across the ground and disrupting the environment. The purpose of this tax credit was to give them some help in making that transition. That transition is still going on. You often will find these people only work for 3, 4, or 5 months a year doing this type of work, yet they have to have the equipment there all year long. The tax credit's appropriate. Ending the ability to have it sunset, I think, is also appropriate. This is something that should be permanent and long-term, so these people can continue to invest in this equipment to continue to do what I consider environmentally correct logging. The loss of these jobs in our area would be significant, not only for the people involved directly, but for companies like Boise Cascade that rely on these people to bring them the logs they need for processing plants, of which one of the largest ones is in your district, in my district, I'd point out. Okay. So having said that, I think this is really something that should go forward quickly and easily. I wouldn't quite call it a no-brainer, but it's pretty close. And I'd like to see it pass through and go on to the Senate, become law, and remove the sunset. Thank you.
Thank you. No questions. Thank you, Representative Bates.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. Jim Geisinger.
Chairman Gilman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I'm the Executive Vice President of Associated Oregon Loggers. We're a trade group that represents almost 1,000 contract loggers in the state of Oregon, and it's on their behalf that I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. With me is Mary Betts with More Fiber from Sweet Home, Oregon. Her husband, Gary, was scheduled to testify, but like many of our members, he was called into action early this morning to run a piece of equipment that normally would have been run by another employee who was recently injured, so she'll be testifying on his behalf. And to my right is Bob Luato, the president of Cross and Crown Incorporated out of Carlton, Oregon. I'm going to provide a brief overview of the history of what brings us here today, and then my two colleagues are going to provide some company-specific examples as to why House Bill 2372 is so important to our industry. After almost a decade of discussion and dialogue in the 90s, a bill was finally passed in 1999 that exempted modern logging equipment, from personal property taxes, much like farming equipment has been exempt since 1973. But during the compromises that go on during political deliberations, there was a clause put into the bill that sunsetted the exemption after tax year 2007. It was advanced. The bill was advanced as an experiment on a trial basis to see how it would work. And I'm here to tell you that it has been a resounding success for our industry and for the communities that depend on our industry. And we encourage you to pass 2372 to strike the sunset and allow this to become a permanent law. Our industry is the second largest industry in the state of Oregon, and it distresses us often to hear some people talk about it in the past tense. We still make a huge economic contribution to this state, and we can continue to do so under proper tax structures such as the exemption of personal property taxes. We are struggling a worldwide economy right now. There are other parts around the world that are competing in our markets that have traditionally belonged to domestic producers, so we've become more competitive, not less, and we need every cost-cutting advantage that we can possibly obtain. As already has been mentioned by Representative Smith, a lot of our equipment sits idle many months of the year, just like farming equipment. It's used seasonally, and yet under the old law, personal property taxes were assessed on the full value of that equipment every single year. There's also a bureaucratic nightmare both for our members and county assessors in collecting these taxes, in that this equipment works in different counties throughout the year who have different tax rates, have different valuation tables, and the cost that is associated with collecting these taxes is very, very substantial, and in some counties is actually larger than the revenue that's generated from the program. We are asking to have parity with the agricultural industry. As I mentioned, since 1973, farming equipment has been exempt. The parallels between our industry and that one are quite stark. We're talking about family-owned businesses, equipment with huge capital investments associated with it. You know, 20 years ago, for $25,000, you could buy yourself a cat and be in the logging business. Today, if you don't have $2 million behind you, there's no sense in even trying to start. And a lot of our members are facing the reality that their equipment is getting older and worn out. A lot of our members are in their 50s. They want to upgrade their equipment. They want to buy new equipment so they can prepare for the future. But they realistically have to have a 5 to 7 year horizon in front of them to justify those costs. They have to know where that work is going to come from. So the bottom line is we need a shot in the arm in our industry. I think it would behoove the legislature to send a positive signal to our industry by passing House Bill 2372. Tell us that we have a future. Tell our industry that we are appreciated and that we can continue to be a part of the social and economic fabric of our state. This is also necessary to plan for the future. Unless we know what our tax structure is going to be into the future, it's hard to justify the capital investments that we're looking at today. Finally, I want to call to your attention a couple of newspaper articles that I attached to my testimony, both coming from the Oregonian. One describes a study that was done at Oregon State University that explains that the loggers were really left behind by the previous administration in the imposition of the Northwest Forest Plan. There were 30,000 jobs lost in our industry during the 1990s. Half of those jobs just vanished. The people left the state to pursue other livelihoods. The other 15,000 of those people went to work in the service and trade sectors for wages that were substantially less than the family wage jobs that they had in the logging and forest products industry. This study documents the fact that our industry is hurting. The second article also cites a study regarding the economic assistance package that the Clinton administration allegedly provided for displaced loggers. It was an utter failure that brought no new money to the state, but frankly repackaged and put new window dressing on existing programs. So we're still hurting. I think we're hurting more than other parts of the economy, and because of this, we need House Bill 2372. This personal property tax is not a fair one, and we think there's all of the good reasons in the world to strike the exemption and allow it to become a permanent law. Thank you.
Questions?
No.
Okay.
Next. Okay, Chairman Gilman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Luato, and I'm president of Cross & Crown, which is a company located in Carlton, Oregon. We are a third-generation logging company, and my son currently plans to carry on the tradition as a fourth generation, provided there's some economic opportunity to do so. In this regard, I do appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2372. I testified on the bill in 1995 that was eventually passed in 1999 to exempt modern logging equipment from personal property taxes. Included in this 1999 bill was a provision to terminate the exemption at the end of the tax year 2007. The intent was to implement the exemption on a trial basis. I am back here today to tell you that has been an outstanding success and has produced the intended results. House Bill 2372 will strike the termination provision in the 1999 law and make the exemption permanent. I urge you to pass it out of your committee. Our story is a familiar one. It was not too long ago that our company did 95% of its work on federal forest land. And today we do 95% of our work on private and state lands. Nearly all our jobs once involved second growth forests, or now involve second growth forests, which are a significant amount of commercial thinning and small diameter timber. If we are lucky enough to have access to the federal timber sales in the future, it is almost certain that the opportunities will be in thinning, overstocked plantations planted decades ago. This type of logging requires modern, sophisticated, and expensive equipment in order to perform in an environmentally responsible way. That's a lot of the equipment that we get from the Scandinavian countries that has complete computerized systems and requires training and whatnot. In 1999, the property tax exemption helped me acquire and maintain the equipment necessary to do this type of work. Our industry is a very competitive one right now. Margins are razor thin, and successful loggers are those that can take advantage of every cost control opportunity. I can testify that the current exemption has helped our company remain competitive, obtain and maintain modern equipment, and provide the benefits our employees need and contribute to our community's economy. By passing House Bill 2372 now, our industry will be better able to plan for the future. You can provide us the certainty we need to make needed investments. By making the property tax exemption permanent today, you will send a signal to our industry that you value our contribution to the state's economy and that you would like to help us succeed in the future. I do urge you all to pass House Bill 2372. Is there any questions?
Questions, Robert?
How long would a piece of this type of equipment last?
As far as before we have to update it again?
Right.
Well, I've got a piece of equipment now that we call them delimmers, which automatically process, run the complete tree through, segment it all out and everything. It lasts about 4 to 5 years. And they're about $400,000. So they're fairly high maintenance, fairly high cost, and that's being required to do a lot of the smaller timber that we're seeing now. We're obviously in smaller timber, and if the feds do come back online, that's obviously what we're going to be doing is overstock small thinning projects. So we're going to be doing a lot more of that. That's just one piece. And the piece of equipment from Scandinavia that I was talking about are about, you're looking at $800,000 to $1 million to get a set that will work the way that is required now, environmentally sensitive and take care of the land. So,
quick follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you. And if this was not in effect at this point in time, you would be taxed on the full value the entire time that you were using this, and
mm-hmm.
it would not be a depreciating?
It's a yearly tax. It's just a flat, and it depends on which county you're in, how much they tax you. It's a continual, year-by-year setup. So,
and it doesn't depreciate as
no.
age?
No. They'll allow you some devaluation of the equipment. But we had a lawyer, when we had this, that's all he did was handle this, and we continually did battle with the counties every year on valuations. And he'd get half of it, and we'd get the other half.
Thank you.
Additional question? Thank you. Now, Mary.
Chairman Gilman and members of the committee, my name is Mary Betts, and I'm the corporation secretary for More Logs Fiber Incorporated, based in Sweet Home, Oregon. We are a small, family-owned firm that has been in the logging business for some 32 years. Passage of House Bill 2372 will be very helpful in allowing us to continue. Therefore, we appreciate the opportunity to testify. Before commenting on the importance of property tax exemption on our logging equipment, I'd like to give you some background on our company and the challenges that it's faced. For roughly 30 years, my husband was a partner with other family members in a relatively large logging company that employed nearly 70 employees. We relied heavily on buying federal timber sales and contracting with mills to log federal timber sales that they'd purchased. During the decade of the 90s, those timber sales virtually disappeared. Because of the decline in federal timber, it was necessary to dissolve our partnership in 2000, at which time my husband and I formed the new company we own today. The significance of this history is that the legislature passed a law, passed a bill in 1999 to exempt modern, environmentally sensitive logging equipment from personal property taxes. This bill was very timely and helpful to us in transforming a company that relied on regeneration, harvesting on federal lands, to one that emphasized mechanized equipment fitting second growth stands on private lands. Our mechanized equipment is expensive to purchase and expensive to maintain. The property tax exemption helped us immensely in making this transition. Making the exemption permanent will help assure our company's future. Even with our specialized equipment, we cannot operate 12 months a year. Sometimes our equipment sits idle, and when it does, it generates no revenue. Yet prior to 1999, this equipment was taxed on its full assessed value, regardless of how busy we could keep it. This simply is not a fair tax. The fact that we work in multiple counties with different tax rates and procedures create a bureaucratic nightmare for us as well as the county assessors. Finally, we view ourselves in much the same way as family farmers. The similarity between the two industries is stark. Farming equipment has been exempt from personal property taxes since 1973. We think our logging equipment should be too. House Bill 2372 will remove a provision from the 1999 bill that would sunset the existing property tax exemption and make it a permanent law. Many of us are facing the reality of replacing and upgrading our equipment. It would be helpful to know now that the exemption will continue in the future to making these investments. I urge you to pass House Bill 2372. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. Maybe Mr. Geisinger knows. If I could, please. Does this include helicopters?
No, it doesn't. I don't believe that it does. That's a good question that I would be happy to research and get back to you. I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that's what the drafters of the bill were thinking about when it was passed. They were talking about skyline yarders, swing yarders, and modern mechanized ground-based yarding systems.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might just ask Mr. Geisinger a procedural question if you're comfortable answering it. I realize this is not on our schedule today for a work session, but I mean, based on your understanding of this bill and the lack of fiscal impacts, your sense is that if this committee looks favorably on this bill, we should just be able to send it straight to the floor. Is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, yes, it is. There is no revenue or fiscal impact for this biennium of this bill. And furthermore, I know there's been a concern expressed that this expands the amount of equipment that is exempt from property taxes. That is not true. The amount of equipment that is covered today would be the same as the amount of equipment covered if the exemption was lifted. Obviously, future purchases, future equipment would be exempt, but as we sit here today, it would not increase the amount of equipment subject to the exemption.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you feel the fact that this sunset is there now is kind of putting a damper on the purchase of equipment?
I believe it is. Our members tell us it is, Mr. Chairman and Representative Beyer. I would defer to my two colleagues to answer that question. Bob, you might want to take a shot at that.
Yeah. Well, what we're looking for is a long-term plan, because if we're going to stay and continue to invest, you know, several million dollars, which I know Mary and our company has to look at, you need to have that kind of a certainty that you can look down the line. And with the rising cost of health insurance, which I'm sure all as representatives you're aware of, it's starting to really bite every company, and we're trying to maintain a family wage job and issue family wage benefits. And to do that, this helps us with our employees as well. So it gives us that security, and then we can offer them that same security and pass it on. So,
Mary, do you want to join in?
No, I totally agree with what's been said.
Tell by the nodding, but the tape can't tell that.
If you're looking at 400,000 plus machine, looking at a property tax on top of that, it a lot of times will mean there's not a lot of profit margin there. And so, yes, definitely impacts whether you try to repair the old machine or whether you go with the new.
Further questions? Thank you. Thank all of you.
Thank you.
Gil Riddell.
members of the committee, I'm Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I have some written remarks. If anyone understands the plight of loggers, it's county government. Our timber-dependent counties rise and fall with the fortunes of the in the market. So it's not with a lack of empathy that we oppose this bill in its current form and recommend that you keep the subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee because, as you'll see in my remarks, there are several revenue questions that are raised. I'd like first to give a background on the law that they're seeking to amend and state reasons for that position. Back in 1999, these statutes, the series of statutes in ORS 307, was a product of an agreement between the Associated Oregon Loggers and the Association of Oregon Counties. It was to be an eight-year trial. AOC agreed to provide property tax incentives to loggers to acquire new categories of newer and more environmentally sensitive equipment. When the piece of equipment became older than 8 years, it would return to the tax roll. It's much like a enterprise zone theory where you forgive taxes for a period of time and then afterwards the property and its improvements are returned to the rolls. Oregon counties are also partners in the Oregon plan. This agreement was a trial intended to help loggers and to move closer to the goals of the Oregon plan. It sunsets in July 1, 2008, thus forcing legislative review as to whether it has met its goals. The reasons for our concern. The law doesn't sunset until 2008, so we're wondering what the hurry is. There'll be two more legislative sessions between now and then to determine to review this policy. We don't know whether the statutes are meeting their intended purpose. The latest current tax expenditure report notes at page 259 that it's too new to tell. We don't know if it's working. Proponents, at the least, should answer whether more environmentally sensitive equipment was purchased specifically and whether it was used as a result of this law and what effect this law has had on the landscape. This bill actually broadens current law. By changing the definition of equipment in lines 10 and 11, the bill opens the exemption to any equipment manufactured on or after January 1, 1992. Since the bill would make this definition permanent, in 20 years, this exemption would apply to 30-year-old equipment. This in spite of the legislative finding as part of this program that it's the public policy of this state to facilitate transition of older logging equipment to newer equipment designed and manufactured to be as environmentally sensitive as current technology can provide. It's likely the technology current in 2023 will be improved over today's technology. Also, as stated in this legislative findings, this is state policy. And here's where a revenue question comes in. Counties face the very same budget crises that you do. Critical health and safety services for county residents, including loggers, are in jeopardy. And I know this is anecdotal, but I hope it's illustrative. Statesman Journal on Sunday did a feature article on budget-driven site and release cycle keeps young offenders free. That's happening all over. Counties are not able to do more than cite offenders. And they go out and continue to pester the community, robbing and stealing, and whatever else they do. Now is not the time to lock in an untested program and thereby spend county, special district, and city property tax revenues to pursue an unconfirmed state policy. If the legislature wishes to enact this state policy permanently, we ask you to comply with your policy in ORS 306, 350 to 359, and share the cost of this expanded property tax exemption by contributing the state's 50% share. I have one comment that's not in the written remarks relative to the comparison with ag equipment, and this again is a revenue question. Ag equipment was exempted in a previous property tax system, a levy-based system, so that when the exemptions were granted in those days, the burden of property taxes to fulfill the levy shifted to other taxpayers. Now we're in a rate-based system. If you grant an exemption now, you're taking money for essential local services directly. The other point to make, and again a revenue point, the ag exemption and this trial logging equipment exemption were adopted before the policy that I just referred to, where the state has said it costs. We decide whether there's a property tax exemption. It costs local governments. So we want to share in the cost of that. So with that, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The help educate a freshman, the last sentence on your testimony, which references ORS 306.350, about the contributing to the state's share of the cost,
yes.
Is that something that the current statute does not include but is included in other statutes in terms of the state sharing in the cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, it's a statement of policy by the state that recognition that in the old days you could grant property tax exemptions and it would shift the burden to other taxpayers. Now it costs money for essential local services. So if this is a state policy and it's important enough to us, we're willing to help pay for it.
If I could just follow up, so maybe help me, is there another example of a case where the state has mandated something that we do share in the cost of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I'm afraid there is not. We'd like to see the policy lived up to. I must say this, though, Mr. Chair, if I may. The last two sessions since the adoption of that policy in 1999, it's had a salutary effect. We have been able to caution committees that the state policy is sensitive to the cost, that it's not to be ignored, and it's managed to help us prevent future exemptions, adoption of exemptions, property tax exemptions.
Further questions? I have a couple. You already stated that there is no state refund or something like that to counties on all the ag equipment that is exempt. Then there is no money coming back. Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? Those exemptions were granted in the day when we were on a levy system. And again, this is a revenue question, but
I've heard that already. You already stated that. How is logging equipment different than ag equipment?
Mr. Chair, I would say that that it often, depending on its use in the landscape, is not different. If it's dealing with plantations, then there's a good argument that it's not different. My point is that this is a specific revenue-related issue and has to do with the tax code and how local governments are treated by the state. So I think, again, that it's an issue for the Revenue Committee.
Appreciate your comment.
Thank you.
No more. Oh.
I thought I have a quick question. Thank you. Maybe you don't know, Mr. Riddell, but can you tell me why every county does it different on the personal property tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'd hesitate to agree with that statement. There are going to be disputes about the actual value of equipment and personal property, for that matter. Personal property has to be accounted for insurance purposes by the owner, for state income tax purposes, and for property tax purposes. So it's not adding to the cost of keeping track of records or anything of that sort. There is, in fact, permitted it's taxed at its current value, so there will be reduction in value as it ages. But I think that the difference would more relate to the value of the equipment and the condition of the equipment than it would to what county the equipment's in.
Follow up?
Yes, certainly, Mr.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So, is there not more record keeping if you work in multiple counties? Are you assessed on how much time you're there, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's a good question. I'm afraid I cannot answer that off the top of my head. And rather than guess, I just soon give you a precise answer.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Is it Riddell?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Riddell, I'm just curious, this went into effect in 99?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, it did.
So I'm assuming that this is, that we taxes are generally paid on an annual basis, not a biennial.
Mm-hmm.
Biennial. So did you testify against this bill last year, too? The last session? I don't recall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, this bill was not brought to you, as far as I know, last session. This is a brand new agreement that we entered with these with the Associated Oregon Loggers in 1999, and it's intended to be a trial basis with an extended sunset date, 8 years. So I was a little surprised to see the bill, but I wanted to make sure the committee understood the nature of that first agreement and the fact that you have some time to decide. You don't need to do that today, and there are too many revenue questions embodied in the concept for you to go forward with it, in my opinion.
Yeah. Follow up, please. So what are they?
Mr. Chair,
what are those questions?
I'll try to highlight my points. The purpose of the original agreement was to facilitate the transition to environmentally sensitive logging equipment. There is a tax expenditure. For tax expenditures, there's a tax expenditure report written every biennium, and the report for 03-05 indicates that it is too new to determine whether this expenditure is actually meeting its purpose. So,
let me find out, please, Mr. Chair, who said that it's not, or we don't know if it's following the environmental...
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, there's a...
DAS, or...
Well, it's an official publication put out by the Department of Revenue, and they seek advice from agencies that are closest to the policy that's being asserted by various tax expenditures.
So, Mr. Chair, please, let me finish. Mr. Dell, so the counties are worried that this equipment is not being sensitive to the, is not the use of equipment sensitive to the environment. Is that what you're concerned about right now, the counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we would like to see the agreement in place for a while longer to give it some time.
What? Sorry?
For a while longer, rather than decide that it's working when we simply do not know that it's working. I haven't seen evidence of an increase in purchases of this category of equipment. Other matters that have to be asked as to whether this policy is actually working, which would be the policy to be followed under the tax expenditure report.
I'm getting that report. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Riddell.
One more.
Well, I can't get the first one yet, so I'm just wanting to find out first. You said it's the purchase of the environmentally sensitive equipment, or we don't know if anybody's bought any.
Chair Representative Nelson, thank you for having me clarify it. My second bullet indicates that it's both. That are people buying it, and how is it working on the landscape?
Okay, so since 1999, there's been nobody able to tell you if any of this tell the counties if any of this equipment has been bought and ascertain if it's sensitive to the environment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the tax expenditure report says it's too soon to tell if this is working, if this policy is working. That's what we're going by. We're not the proponents of the bill, Representative Nelson. We'd like to see some evidence, and there isn't evidence in the tax expenditure report, so that's where we're stuck.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And from the Department of Forestry, Joe Isaac.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman and members of the committee. My name is Joe Mishak. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Forestry, and it's my pleasure to be in front of you this afternoon. The Department of Forestry, one of the advantages, I guess, after a lot of testimony has already been heard by the committee, so I'll try not to read my testimony to you, but maybe point out some additional things that are in our testimony that haven't already been brought out in front of the committee. The point was made that this is, or that agriculture already does enjoy a property tax exemption, and I provided a statute reference there, and it's listed in the front part of my testimony. In terms of ag equipment being able to utilize that equipment with a tax exemption for the harvesting of crops. In the 1993 legislative session, through ORS 321-259 in Western Oregon and ORS 321-410 in Eastern Oregon, through the forest land and severance tax system, the 93 legislature recognized that timber is a crop in Oregon, that there is substantial investment that goes into raising the crop of trees on the forest land. And so that is the public policy of the state of Oregon now, that timber be treated as a crop. So the Department of Forestry is in favor of House Bill 2372 in terms of serving to extend to those folks that try to harvest timber on forest land, that they still enjoy the same property tax exemption that is afforded to folks in the agricultural industry. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Yes, Representative Nelson, always.
Well, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Mishak, I'm just concerned that that we can account for equipment that's good for the environment if we call it ag, but if we call it, you know, something else, timber harvesting, we can't ascertain that it was bought after a certain period. I'm wondering why the ag community's been so fortunate in having accounts that can account for their equipment.
Chair Gilman and
who does it?
Representative Nelson, I'm sorry, I don't know that I understand your question. Could you just hear it for me, please?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Mishak, is that right?
Correct.
How come you are able to, or somebody is able to ascertain if equipment that's purchased for agriculture endeavors is indeed, you know, a benefit to the environment, but we cannot ascertain that timber harvesting equipment is good for the environment? Is it the same group who determines this?
Chair Gilman and Representative Nelson, I believe that the legislature, through its policy making, both on behalf of the agricultural industry and then later in 99 for the logging industry, made that call in terms of we have only so much resource land in the state of Oregon, and we'd like to have that to encourage production of crops on those resource lands. And so I think that, that we do have public policy for both forest land and for agricultural land. I think the question before us in this bill is whether we should continue and maybe even broaden a little bit those benefits to forest land, to the logging community in terms of their equipment. That's my understanding.
Representative Worth.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Mishak, can you give me an idea of just how much more environmentally sound these different pieces of equipment are? And I mean, how much of a difference do they actually make?
Chair Gilman and Representative Worth, I am not a logging expert. I have had the opportunity and been afforded the opportunity to go and look at equipment out operating on forest land sites through our forest practices program, and have looked at some of this equipment before it even came over, and looking at it operating in Norway. The advances in technology with logging equipment are just astounding compared to the days when I was working in the woods in 73 to about 85. So we have made some significant improvements in terms of capability of those machines.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Byer.
I'm wondering if you're the person to ask about this. On the piece that adds in January 1st, 1992, from what I was gathering from earlier testimony, it sounded like a lot of this equipment doesn't have a real long life. So I'm wondering about the need to go back to that point and please correct me if I'm wrong in my assumption that maybe this is starting to get pretty old for equipment, or is that unusual?
Chair Gilman and Representative Beyer, I know of some logging equipment that's been around for much longer than 92. That payment probably it's equally as important as the kind of equipment it is the skill in which the operator that takes the equipment and then goes out and tries to harvest timber on forest land. Of course, we have forest practice foresters that are out on the site trying to make sure that environmental damage does not occur. That's a part of Department of Forestry's responsibilities. But that 1992 is a number in terms of recognizing that at that point in time, there's probably newer equipment that's out there. There's probably also equipment that is older than that out there and may not be as environmentally sensitive as 1992. But I would not state that as a date that just magically everything beyond that point forward that's manufactured is going to be much lighter hand on the land. A lot of it depends on the finesse of the operator operating those machines.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Meese. I think that's all we have signed up for House Bill 2372, so I'll close the hearing on 2372. And next up is 2258. Ray, you have
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2258 extends the sunset of surcharge on combination and hunting licenses imposed for access and habitat programs. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. And the current surcharge, Mr. Chair, on combination hunting licenses was enacted in 93, amended in 97 and 99. Last amendment placed a $2 surcharge on resident and non-resident licenses and a $1 surcharge on juvenile licenses. Mr. Chair, 2258 today is scheduled for an informational hearing only.
And I have three people signed up, I believe. So first would be Doug Tyndale.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tyndale, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. ODOT has some concerns with this bill. I'll try and describe them briefly. The concern we don't have is that we do understand the value of trees. However, in the situation that we're in terms of funding...
Wait a minute. Wrong bill.
Sorry. I wasn't listening. I just heard my name.
I was just sure.
My apologies. I'll be back.
No.
We just need to move to your bill.
We need to bring up
three. Are we doing 2507 today? We weren't these people.
So, do we have anybody signed up for it?
No, there is no sign up here for me.
Just get to me.
Yes.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Eric Rickerson, Federal Aid and Landowner Assistance Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And with me today is Susan Barnes. Susan is the Access and Habitat Program Coordinator for the department. We've been asked to come to the committee today to provide an overview of the program and answer any questions that you may have. So at the committee's leisure, we can start with the presentation we put before you. The Access and Habitat Program was created by the 67th Oregon Legislative Assembly with the passage of House Bill 2538 during the 1993 legislature. This bill was strongly supported by coalitions of both hunters and landowners. The program was reauthorized by the legislature in 1997 with passage of House Bill 2188, extending the program through December 2003. The convening of the 2003 Oregon Legislature marks the 10th year of this program's existence, and it provides a good opportunity for us to reflect on the program's accomplishments during this past 10 years. The primary objectives of the Access and Habitat Program are threefold. First, it provides an incentive-based program to improve wildlife habitat and public hunting access to private lands in Oregon. Secondly, it's designed to recognize and encourage the contributions made by landowners to Oregon's fish and wildlife resources. This contribution is made in the form of a stewardship that affects approximately 50% of the state's land base. And lastly, it's designed to promote cooperative working relationships between landowners, hunters, and the department. The importance of this third objective is highlighted by the program's motto, Landowners and Hunters Together for Wildlife. House Bill 2538 established a 7-member board to provide oversight for the A&H program. Board members are appointed by the Fish and Wildlife Commission and may serve a 4-year term in which they could be reappointed, but may not serve more than 2 consecutive terms. The makeup of the board is balanced by 3 landowner representatives representing the agriculture and timber landowning community, 3 hunter representatives, and 1 public representative that serves as chair. In addition to the board, the legislation also established 6 regional advisory councils comprised in the same proportion as the state board. The primary duties of the council are to review A&H projects within their geographic region and to make recommendations, to the state board. In addition to the board and regional councils, 1 permanent full-time position was authorized within the Wildlife Division that serves as the A&H program coordinator. The coordinator is responsible for managing, directing, or coordinating the activities of the board, councils, and ODFW field staff and program applicants. In addition, the coordinator is also responsible for carrying the board's recommendations to the commission for review and action. Within each regional council, 1 ODFW employee, as part of their normal duties, serves as in the role as the liaison between the council and program applicants. So they're there to answer questions and assist in presenting the projects to the council based on their technical expertise. One of the other facets of the A&H coordinator provides for the program is that the individual is responsible for developing materials for program outreach, in which I passed out to the committee today for your review. These outreach materials include a quarterly newsletter. It also includes a background or a pamphlet, basically giving a general overview of the program. In addition, one of the primary duties in this outreach program is providing biennial reports to the Oregon Legislature. And I'd like to make note for the committee that Susan is in the process of completing the 01-03 biennial report, and it should be available to the committee within the next month.
The Access and Habitat Program funding is derived from 3 main sources.
State your name.
Oh, for the record, my name is Susan Barnes, and I'm the department's Access and Habitat Program Coordinator. So again, the program funding comes from 3 sources, a $2 surcharge on the sale of each hunting license, allocations from ODFW's Green Forage and Deer Enhancement and Restoration Programs, and proceeds from the auction and raffle of up to 10 deer and 10 elk tags annually. As I just mentioned, the auction and raffle hunt program provides revenue to the Access and Habitat Program. And by statute, the commission can authorize up to 10 deer and elk tags, and they have authorized these deer and elk tags. 10 are to be auctioned, 10 raffled. And the Access and Habitat Board is committed to splitting these tags between the auction and raffle hunts. The auction and raffle program is gaining popularity in the public. And if you take a look at the revenues over the past 10 years, the revenue is increasing. This slide here depicts that revenue since 94. As you can see, there is an upward trend in the revenue that's been generated by both the raffle hunts and the auction hunts. The NH program funding results in grants to private landowners, timber and agricultural corporations, sportsman groups, natural resource agencies, and others for projects designed to improve wildlife habitat and increase public access to private lands. Some of these habitat projects include wetland restoration, riparian protection, forage and cover plantings, controlled burns, meadow, pasture fertilization, water development, range rehabilitation, noxious weed control, and land acquisition and trades. Some of the types of hunter access projects that have been implemented through the program include regulated hunt programs, travel management areas, access improvements, and projects where volunteers maintain and check gates to private landowner lands. Just to give you a quick overview of how these projects get on the ground and through the board and regional councils, the applicants complete the applications and they're submitted to either the state or regional coordinator. And then the applications go to the regional advisory council, which are again citizen boards comprised of landowner and hunter representatives and a chair. The regional councils make their funding recommendations and then the applications go on to the state board for their review. And when reviewing the applications, the board takes into several considerations. They are mandated to, or they're encouraged by the statute to recommend for funding a mix of projects that balances both access and habitat throughout the state, and to recommend projects that alleviate wildlife damage, projects that include matching funds, and projects that include a high level of volunteer participation. After the board reviews and recommends projects, then the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission is presented with those recommendations and they take final action on whether or not to approve or deny funding. With projects that are approved by the commission, the funds are then dispersed through ODFNW once a signed cooperative agreement is developed between the grantee and ODFNW. And this whole application process takes about 3 months to complete. If you looked at the funding over the past 10 years, approximately one-third of the funding that's involved here has come from the Access and Habitat Program. The other two-thirds has come from cooperative sources. And actually in 99 and 01, the cost share was 1-4 approximately. So the program is actually leveraging a significant amount of cost share dollars from other sources, landowners and other groups. And if you look at the breakdown of the habitat versus access projects that are being implemented, in 99 and 01, approximately a quarter of the projects were habitat-only projects. Approximately the other quarter was access, and then the other 50% were projects that had both an access and habitat component. So there is a good balance going on between access and habitat. Just to give you an idea of some of the types of projects that have been implemented through the program, one is the Murderers Creek Winter Range shrub planting project. And here in just last year, over 263 volunteers helped the Redmond chapter of the Oregon Hunters Association plant over 20,000 native shrubs on 400 acres of the Philip W. Schneider Wildlife Area. And this was to improve the habitat for approximately 2,000 deer and 1,200 elk that use this area as critical winter range. An example of an access project that's been implemented would be the Willamette Private Lands Law Enforcement Project. And the situation here was that due to vandalism and garbage dumping and various wildlife violations, the private timber companies in the Northwest were concerned and began to limit access to their lands. Well, an access and habitat grant has allowed over 1.2 million acres of those private timberlands to remain open by providing funds that pay for Oregon State Police to patrol those lands. Another example of a more recent project, this past year was a severe fire season, and the Access and Habitat Board allocated, with the approval of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission, $200,000 to assist private landowners in reseeding their lands affected by wildfire. Well, not all of that money was spent, but about $132,000 of it was spent. And this here shows an example of a private land affected and reseeded before and after through this Access and Habitat program. So in summary, I'd like to summarize some accomplishments. About 250 projects have been implemented since 93. $4.7 million of A&H funds have been expended. About $11 million of cooperator contributions have also assisted in putting those projects on the ground. About 718,000 acres of habitat has been enhanced, and over 9.7 million acres of new private lands have been opened to hunter access. And over 400 organizations and individuals have been involved in implementation of these projects. If you look at the original authorizing legislation, it's obvious that the legislative intent has been met. We have an active and effective board, and six regional advisory councils. Many acres of habitat have been created and improved, and many more acres of public hunting access has been provided, giving hunters and other recreationists new opportunities. Cooperative funding has been leveraged, and working relationships between landowners, hunters, private timber companies, and others have been fostered and improved. And the role that private landowners have in being stewards of the natural resources here in Oregon has been recognized. And before we open it up to questions, I would like to introduce Mr. Bob Lund and Mr. Tick Warner. Bring them up to answer any questions and also to provide their input. Mr. Bob Lund is a hunter representative on the Access and Habitat Board from LeGrand, and Mr. Tick Moore is from Vail, and he is a landowner representative on the board.
Questions?
Come on up. I have a couple.
Sit on my lap.
The board and the individual councils that you have around the state, are they paid or all volunteer situation?
Mr. Chairman, none of the board members, either on the regional boards or on the state boards, are paid. We get the state board members, we get our expenses paid when we have a meeting, and we try to spread the meetings out around the state. We have three general meetings a year, and then the fourth meeting on a quarterly basis is usually a telephone conference. So, no, we're not paid for that.
And one other question. The last time I was in Prineville, I visited with a couple of farmers, and there's a group of elk that live out in the sagebrush, but they like the alfalfa field better than the sagebrush. Do you help farmers out at all in trying to limit that or pay the farmers for the damage from the animals?
Your turn. You know this one. Yeah. I'm the Eastern Oregon Landowner Representative, Mr. Chairman. I'm also the Vice Chairman of the Board. Yes, we do. We have tried to alleviate damage where possible. One project that comes to mind, in fact, Bob and I were talking about it coming over. We have a landowner who's done a project. He has offered up his last cutting of alfalfa for wildlife feed to keep him off his neighbor's land. And that, you know, that's the kind of program that this program started out to be, was one to foster relationships between a department, landowners, and sportsmen. And this gentleman I'm referring to allows hunting on his property. He allows the elk to winter on his property in his alfalfa fields in exchange for a little fertilizer and a little help with his irrigation. So to answer your question, yes, we do.
And you've stated your name. Susan has stated, but
I'm Bob Lund. I'm from LeGrand.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Very informative.
Okay, thank you.
May I just ask one question, Mr. Chair?
Oh, certainly. Representing else.
This is probably to, what's the young man's name? First young man?
Mr. Rickerson.
Rickerson?
Yes.
Is part of that increase in the hunting license, increase for this program? No?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, no, it is not.
Other questions?
Thank Mr. You. Chairman, before I go, there is one thing. I'm going to play a card, even though Ron will throw something at me. We do have an amendment that the board has brought forward to completely remove the sunset clause, and I don't know that I'm going to get back all the way from Vail to testify to that. So I want you to know that the Eastern Oregon contingent of the Access and Habitat Program strongly support removing the sunset and letting this program continue to grow and be able to do long-range projects other than once every 2 years.
The amendment's mine, as a matter of fact, and it will, when we do a regular hearing and the work session, it'll be in there. And
for what it's worth, you know, I don't know that I can get back, and I just want you to know that we support it. So thank you.
Thank you.
This closes the informational session on 2258. Now. And now we'll open the hearing on 2507. Ray.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2507 establishes a municipal street tree restoration program, Department of Forestry, to be administered in cooperation with Department of Transportation. It establishes a municipal street tree restoration account within the Department of Treasury, which is separate and distinct from the general fund. It creates a program advisory committee and requires transfer of 25 cents from each vehicle's registration fee into the municipal street tree restoration account. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. And now, Doug, we'll try it again. And I apologize. It's just as much my fault as it was yours.
That's what you get for being outside. Chair Gilman, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I appreciate the time to rethink my position on this bill. However, I still have concerns I'd like to express on the part of the Department of Transportation. As I said, we're not anti-tree. We think it's what's proposed here is a laudable goal, provided there are revenues to deal with all of the needs that are out there. We don't feel that in our current funding situation that we have all of the revenues we need to deal with all of the transportation problems, so we have some concerns about taking some of our scarce revenues and devoting them to this purpose. Specifically, this bill plants trees to improve safety. The department is, there's a current statute that requires the department to spend $100 million annually on safety aspects. We actually spend more than that on safety aspects. That's our primary concern. If we move money to planting trees will take away from our normal priority list of kind of worst first, where we have a demonstrated accident history. Also of concern to us is that the way this bill is constructed, it takes away only a share of ODOT's revenues and not cities and counties' revenues, but yet it would allow these expenditures to be applied to any road or street, be that state, county, or city. So it's taken from the state and potentially giving it to the counties and cities. And third, and we did not ask for this advice. This was unsolicited from the Attorney General's office, but they saw this bill and informed us that they believe that this bill would, the expenditures described in this bill would constitute an unconstitutional use of state highway funds. So House Bill 2507 takes away from revenues that we need for transportation, and so we have some concerns with it. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to remember the figures of how many registrations we do per year and what this would amount to.
Chair Gilman, Representative Beyer, the fiscal is about $500,000 a year. I don't have the exact number with me.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. Chris Nemetso, I'm sorry about the bad. You tell me how to pronounce it.
It's Namsu, Chris Namsu.
Okay.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, I want to begin by thanking you for the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss House Bill 2507, the Municipal Street Tree Restoration Program. My name is Chris Namsu. I'm the recently elected president of Oregon Community Trees, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that was formed to promote healthy urban and community forests in Oregon through education, awareness, and advocacy. We are a grassroots organization, and we're committed to improving the environmental and economic quality of life in Oregon cities through the proper management of our urban forests. These are the trees where we live. We have members all across the state who share a passion for planting and caring for trees within our communities. Our members realize the valuable contributions trees make to our quality of life in this state. It's for this reason that we propose the Municipal Street Tree Restoration Program, House Bill 2507. House Bill 2507 has two primary components. The first component would establish a program to manage the green part of our transportation infrastructure within urban growth boundaries, and the second provides a funding mechanism for cities to receive grant funds and technical assistance related to the planting and maintenance of street trees. I fully realize the problematic nature of requesting funding in very tight fiscal times such as these, and we are very open to suggestions from the committee or any other concepts that might be offered today to help us try to resolve some of those problems. The bill would create a partnership between the Transportation and Forestry Department, and that relationship would have lasting benefits. The bill represents a small step to recognize the value of trees to our city environments. Street trees play an important role in our transportation infrastructure. Research has shown that trees planted along roads are one effective tool for calming the traffic, encouraging drivers to travel slower and more safely, obeying the speed limit more often. Trees planted along roadways can reduce glare and also can prevent erosion of the roadway subsurface as well as bridge abutments. By planting more trees in urban areas, we can mitigate some of the pollution created by motor vehicles. By planting and maintaining street trees, we can increase the safety of the transportation corridors. Street trees provide many environmental benefits, as I'm sure you're all aware. They reduce runoff and help to prevent erosion by stabilizing the soil. They can cool our cities, which preserves energy. They help reduce flooding. They filter stormwater runoff from the roadways and thereby reduce the pollutants that enter our streams, which benefit a wide range of aquatic life. Trees also provide valuable habitat for birds and small mammals. Landscaping is a necessary activity to highway construction and maintenance. We all want to travel down beautiful highways. It gives our community an identity and uniqueness. Trees can be the delivery system for a wide range of community benefits, including economic and social benefits. Tree-lined streets help create vibrant downtown areas, which stimulates economic development and can, in turn, create jobs. They can increase tourism and enhance the livability of communities. These are all things that this program can help to deliver to cities. Research has shown that people prefer to shop in beautifully landscaped areas, spending more time and spending more money and staying longer. If we don't manage the trees along our rights of way, they can become hazardous, thereby becoming a liability rather than an asset. Properly planted and maintained trees are less likely to create traffic hazards. This bill will improve the maintenance of trees within the highway right-of-way by ensuring that the right trees are planted in the right places, thereby creating a safer highway for the traveling public. Some may question if we can afford this bill. Perhaps a better question is to ask how long we can afford not to have this bill. For too long, we have ignored the maintenance needs of our green infrastructure. The situation with the declining salmon populations, the floods and landslides that we experienced in 1996, and other events have reminded us that we can't get away with such decisions forever. There will never be a time when people say, sure, we have enough money to do that. The obvious truth is that we don't have the money to do everything, which is why we must make choices and set priorities. This isn't just a question of money. It's a question of will and vision. As far back as 1929, when Governor I.L. Patterson appointed a commission to preserve roadside trees and develop state parks. Today, we do have a great park system, but the legacy of managing our roadside trees has not been realized. For the past 74 years, we haven't made it a priority to plant and care for trees in our communities. We have paved a lot of miles of road and set a lot of concrete, but we have planted comparably few trees. This is an opportunity to put trees on an equal footing with other aspects of right-of-way maintenance and dedicate funds for that purpose. The bill does not ask that we neglect one right-of-way asset in favor of another, but rather that we realize that the green infrastructure needs maintenance as much as the gray infrastructure does. And it suggests that a small fraction of highway maintenance dollars be dedicated to trees. This bill could be a win-win proposition for the highway department, which gets a chance to improve its stewardship of the natural resources of the state, for the Department of Forestry, which can extend the benefits of its urban forestry program to more cities, for the cities themselves, who will reap the benefits of a greener, more livable community, and for the legislature, which has the opportunity to make a statement that the trees in this state do matter to our quality of life. Trees play an important role in the environmental well-being and economic vitality and community livability of Oregon cities. Many Oregonians are familiar with the Portland Park blocks, Ladd's Addition subdivision, or Ashland's Lithia Park, which are full of stately old trees that give a respite of shade to many on a hot summer afternoon. Urban forests like these are places that were planned by individuals with the kind of foresight that is rarely seen today. In this session, the Oregon Legislature has the opportunity to have the same foresight and establish a program that could leave such a legacy and have a lasting impact for generations to come. Again, I realize that requesting funding in these difficult financial times is problematic. I expect some tough questions on that, and I'm not sure that I'll have good answers. We do have a legislative subcommittee, and unfortunately, those people were unable to be here today, so I'm carrying the ball on behalf of the group, but I'll do my best to answer your questions. What I would hope is a possibility would be that the concept of this bill could be forwarded from this committee onto Ways and Means, and the issue of funding could possibly be addressed. Oregon Community Trees would be more than willing to continue to work with the Department of Transportation and the Department of Forestry to try to come up with other funding mechanisms, and if there was even the possibility of attaching this to a future bill where registration fees might be increased, that would be another possibility that we'd be very interested in possibly working through. That being said, on behalf of Oregon Community Trees and cities across the state, I urge you to pass this bill. I've submitted two letters of support and then a written testimony from myself into the record, and that's going to conclude my testimony. I believe I have some of the statistics that I might be able to answer. Representative Beyer asked of the first speaker, and I can try to go to those if that was helpful. Thank you very much. Chris.
Question? Yes, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nimsu. I think he's busy finding her numbers. Are you answering Representative Beyer at this moment?
If I could look for those while
that's what
you
I
went
thought you were.
That would be great. Thank you.
I'll wait.
How much of it, our numbers state that I have a fact sheet here that how much of an impact is that on ODOT's budget? It says that the program would generate approximately $900,000 per biennium, and that this represents 0.03% or 0.03% of ODOT's total budget for the 1999-2001 biennium, which was $2.89 billion. So those were some statistics that I had from our group.
Mr. Chair, follow up. You said $900,000?
Correct.
For this past biennium or the coming 03-05?
I believe some of the numbers I have, this bill was brought forward last legislative session, so I may have numbers that reflect some of those, some old statistics. And
so there's quite a discrepancy between the two figures. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for a follow-up question.
Chair Gilman, Representative Beyer, my expression of $500,000 was per year. I'm sorry,
okay.
My second legislative faux pas of the day, besides testifying on the wrong bill, I didn't express that in a biennial number, so it's around a million, so they're probably not all that far apart.
But the $125,000 is all, not $900,000. $250,000 biennial.
No. Chair Gilman, let me see if I can clear this up. It's about, and I don't have the fiscal in front of me, but it's about $500,000 per year, which would be $1 million per biennium, and what's suggested here is $900,000 per biennium. So if I'm a little bit high, we could be essentially talking about the same number. I don't believe that our last biennium's budget was $2.89 billion. However, I think it was $1.89 billion.
I had a statistic here that there were approximately 1.8 million motor vehicles were licensed, or are licensed each year in Oregon. 1.8 million motor vehicles.
Okay. Now, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Mr. Nimsu, instead of being a grassroots organization, I think you should be a tree roots organization.
Thank you for that.
Okay. So much for that. Is there a reason that you've chosen a state agency instead of a good city or a good county to be your partner?
We believe that there's a strong link between the pollution that vehicles create and the revenue stream that's generated by the registration fees. So it seems like a logical connection there to offset the pollution created by cars with a tree planting endeavor that benefited our air quality. We did look at several other possible revenue streams, and some of those that we've considered over time would include fines for air and water quality violations, harvest tax on timber sales within urban growth boundaries, economic development funds, lottery funds, private sources, tax checkoffs, a fee on nursery stock produced in the state. There are a number of things that we have considered. We have not looked directly to communities or counties in order to make that partnership.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Just from a program like this, which is in my, I would invite you to see it in my hometown, which is McMinnville, you could probably have the trees now that we've planted. You know, they planted them and now they want them out for some reason. They're really beautiful, though. But what about partnering with businesses?
That is also an excellent suggestion and something that I don't know that we've discussed in great detail.
Just curious.
Take that under advisement. Thank you.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bobby, again. I know you have some testimony here from a mayor, a city, and someone else, but how is the League of Oregon Cities? Have you had any input from them? And I don't know if they were signed up to speak, but I wouldn't mind hearing from them.
Yes, I said cities and counties, and there she is.
Oh.
OK,
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman and committee members. Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities, and no, we weren't signed up to testify this afternoon. The League of Oregon Cities is not supporting this bill at this time. This bill, as you heard, came up last session. There is a big difference in the bill as it was written last session. It would have taken money off of the top of the highway fund, not just out of ODOT's portion, but it raises a couple of very important precedent issues for us. One, the distribution issue with just taking it out of ODOT's share, and two, if you do take money off the top of the road fund, we believe that it's then reorganizing priorities that already exist within cities. As you heard from ODOT, we have substantial maintenance issues with our roads, so every penny counts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Department of Forestry, Paul.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. My name is Paul Reese, and I manage the Urban and Community Forestry Assistance Program in the State Department of Forestry. We appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss House Bill 2507. The concept behind this bill is certainly one that an agency that manages natural resources could support. House Bill 2507, as you heard, establishes a local grant program for street trees, which is one of the least maintained components within street rights-of-ways throughout the state. Unfortunately, trees tend to be one of the last maintenance aspects funded by state transportation agencies. Many jurisdictions only respond to tree emergencies and neglect the preventive maintenance aspects of right-of-way vegetation management. The risks of such not properly maintaining trees in the road's rights-of-way are significant. As the windstorm of February 7, 2002 reminded us, improperly maintained trees can be hazards to our roads and highways. The Department of Forestry and many local communities recognize that it is more cost-effective to properly plant the right street trees and maintain them in healthy conditions than it is to deal with hazardous trees and the property damage caused by property damage and potential loss of life caused by tree failure. Thus, a bill like this one could actually save local transportation agencies money by reducing emergency tree maintenance expenditures. The Department of Forestry has a small federally funded Urban and Community Forestry Assistance Program that provides technical assistance to cities and counties to help them deal with tree issues, including those in the right-of-way. Should the concept contained in this bill be approved by the legislature, we have the professional staff and expertise to administer such a grant program without the development of a new bureaucratic structure. From 1991 to 1995, the department administered a similar grant program solely for tree planting using federal funds provided through the U.S. Small Business Administration. During this period, over $1 million was granted to local jurisdictions for tree planting projects, and these grants leveraged an additional $2 million in local matching expenditures. Since 1995, however, Oregon has lacked a dedicated fund for community tree planting efforts. Although we agree with there is a demonstrated need for a bill of this kind, the Department of Forestry shares the concern of the Department of Transportation regarding the funding mechanism provided for in Section 2 of the Act. Given the fiscal constraints of the impending budget cycle, it seems prudent to identify other state goals that might be met through tree planting efforts and investigate the relevance of this bill to other revenue sources as well. We also agree with the Attorney General's concerns that the Attorney General's concerns should be addressed so that it's clear that all components of the right-of-way maintenance are treated in a consistent manner. Thank you for your time, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions?
I said no.
I guess not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today we do not plan to move any of these bills forward, no work session. Close the hearing on 2507, and unless we have something else, Ray, this meeting is adjourned.
Sound off.
It was.